I want you to just imagine a historical figure for a second.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
So picture a man who emerges from a largely illiterate, highly disorganized tribal society right in the middle of a really harsh, unforgiving desert.
Right, a tough environment.
Exactly. And then within just a few decades, he lays the groundwork for a movement that conquers ancient superpowers and fundamentally rewrites the geopolitical map of the globe. I mean, it sounds like the plot of an epic fantasy novel.
It really does. But, it defies every standard historical expectation we have about how empires are actually born.
Yeah, because usually you need, what, centuries of buildup.
Oh, absolutely. Usually, movements of that sheer scale, they require centuries of infrastructure, massive wealth, and really entrenched state bureaucracies. And this started with literally none of that.
Which is exactly why today's deep dive is just so vital, because before we can even begin to understand how we conquered empires or established a global faith, we have to uncover the blueprint of his character.
Yeah, you have to start with the man himself.
Right. So today, our mission is to explore the early life, the unique traits, and the world of Prophet Muhammad. And for you listening, we are going to synthesize his biography, which is historically known as the Sira, with this really fascinating body of literature called the Shamai.
Ah, the Shamel. I love this tech.
It's incredible, right? It acts as this highly detailed portrait of his personal characteristics, his physical traits, and his day-to-day habits.
It's honestly the perfect approach to a massive subject. Because looking at his early life through the lens of his personal character, it just gives us this vivid, multi-layered picture of who he was as a human being long before he became this global icon.
Okay, let's unpack this because there is a fundamental premise we have to establish right away.
Let's do it.
To understand what a person accomplishes, you have to understand the core of their identity. And that really begins with his names. The two primary names given to him by God are Muhammad and Ahmad.
Right.
And both of those names are rooted in a very specific Arabic word, which is am.
That root word is so essential. In English, we typically translate it as praise, but I mean, that translation feels a bit flat, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really
It
does.
just doesn't quite capture the depth of the original Arabic.
Right, because Ahmad is actually this fusion of two things. It's praise, but also profound gratitude. I was actually thinking about how to visualize this for you guys.
I'd love to hear it.
It's like the difference between praising an incredible Olympic athlete for their sheer talent, right?
Right?
You watch them sprint and say, wow, you're incredibly fast. That's praise.
Sure.
But Ahmed is what you feel when you thank a firefighter who just pulled you out of a burning
Oh,
building.
wow. Yeah.
Right, it's praise for their bravery, but it's inextricably linked to your overwhelming gratitude that they saved your life. Ahmed is inherently deeper.
What's fascinating here is how that linguistic root manifests on a literal global scale today.
Oh, so.
Well, the name Muhammad translates roughly to continuous praise, which indicates an endless quantity. And Ahmed implies the highest, most elevated quality of praise.
Okay, quantity and quality.
Exactly. And when you step back and look at the modern world, there are hundreds of millions of people sending salutations upon him every single second of every day.
That was just, it's hard to even fathom.
It is across time zones, in the call to prayer, in daily worship, even just in casual conversation. The historical and theological assertion is that no human being has ever been or will ever be praised more frequently.
That is a staggering scale to wrap your mind around. And, it culminates in this deeply moving theological narrative regarding the Day of Judgment.
Right, the intercession.
Yes, there is this account detailing how all of humanity will be completely overwhelmed, desperate for the reckoning to begin. They will rush to Adam, then Noah, then Abraham, Moses, and Jesus, basically begging each major prophet to intercede on their behalf.
And they all refuse.
Every single one of them, they refuse, paralyzed by their own perceived unworthiness, saying, myself, myself. And the panic just continues until they finally reach Muhammad.
And his response in that moment is such a defining feature of his theology.
What does he say?
He simply says, "This is my responsibility."
Wow.
He doesn't deflect. He steps right into the breach for all of humanity. It's a moment that elevates him to this exalted cosmic status known as the Station of Praise.
But see, if he just existed in this untouchable cosmic realm, it would be impossible for normal people to connect with him.
Oh, for sure.
What I appreciate so much about the historical texts, the Shamal, is how relentlessly grounded they are. We actually have incredibly poetic yet specific descriptions of what he looked like
We
physically.
really do.
Like, One of his companions compared his face to the full moon, especially when he was happy. Another person said that looking at him was literally like watching the sunrise.
And alongside that poetry, we get very tactile, physical descriptions from people who spent their entire lives beside him.
Like what?
Well, they describe a man who was physically balanced, neither exceptionally tall nor short.
Okay.
His complexion was described as white with a red tinge, which, you know, in the context of 7th century Arabia, meant a robust, tanned, weedish brown.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. He had these large eyes with jet black pupils, long eyelashes, and hair that was reportedly softer than silk, falling somewhere between wavy and straight.
They even documented how he walked.
Yes, the forward lean.
Right. They said he walked briskly, leaning forward slightly as if he were descending a slope. You immediately get this visceral sense of someone with immense physical presence and forward momentum, but who was also entirely approachable.
Which is the perfect pivot to how he actually lived his day-to-day life.
Yes, because if a person possesses that kind of radiant physical presence and holds this uniquely exalted status, you would fully expect their lifestyle to reflect that grandeur.
Naturally.
But the reality is completely jarring. He lived a life of intense asceticism.
It was severe. There was a very famous account involving one of his closest companions, Umar.
Oh, I know this one.
Yeah, Umar walks into the Prophet's small room and finds him sleeping on a rudimentary bed made of rough date palm branches.
Just branches.
Just rough branches. And the material was so coarse and unforgiving that it had left deep physical marks pressed right into the Prophet's back.
That's heartbreaking.
It really is. The visual contrast of the man he revered enduring such discomfort is so overwhelming that Umar actually begins to weep.
Wait, let's just look at human nature for a second here. Usually when someone achieves supreme political and spiritual power, and by this point he was the undisputed leader of an emerging empire, right?
Absolutely.
We expect them to upgrade their lifestyle. It's almost inevitable. Why choose hunger and rough branches when you have thousands of followers who would literally fight each other for the privilege of building you a palace?
It completely upends our assumptions about power.
Yeah.
And Umar asks him that exact question.
He does.
Yeah. He points to the emperors of Rome and Persia, asking why they live in unimaginable luxury while the messenger of God sleeps on the floor.
And what did the prophet say?
His response reframes the entire concept of success. He essentially asks Umar, aren't you satisfied that they have the material world, the dunya, and we have the hereafter?
Wow. And it wasn't just a momentary performance of humility either.
Not at all.
His wife, Aisha, recalled that entire months would go by where they wouldn't even light a fire in their home to cook.
Yes, the two black things.
Exactly. They survived for 6 weeks at a time on what they called the two black things, which were just dates and murky water.
The theological reasoning behind this extreme austerity is actually really profound.
I'd love to hear your take on that.
Well, God specifically chose to send a human being of flesh and blood prone to hunger and fatigue rather than an angel.
Right.
If he lived as an untouchable king in a fortress, completely shielded from the pains of normal life, how could the average person ever emulate his character?
That is such a good point.
How do you look to a wealthy king for guidance when you're struggling to feed your family or navigating a difficult marriage or grieving a terrible loss? His poverty was a deliberate, conscious choice to remain permanently tethered to the most vulnerable members of society.
And that deep humility bled directly into his social interactions, too. Because, I mean, we hear about leaders who claim to be humble but treat their staff terribly behind closed doors.
Oh, all the time.
But there's a companion named Anas ibn Malik who served him for 10 solid years, starting when Anas was just a 7-year-old boy.
Right.
And over an entire decade, Anas reported that the prophet never once even sighed in annoyance at him. He never once said, "Uff."
And kids make mistakes. I mean, there is a brilliant anecdote where he sends young Anas out on an errand.
Okay.
Anas gets distracted, as any child would, and just starts playing with a group of kids on the street, completely forgetting his task.
No, no.
Yeah. But instead of marching over and berating his servant for neglecting his duty, the prophet goes out looking for him, finds him playing, sneaks up behind him, playfully grabs him by the ears, and just smiles.
It is such a remarkably gentle human moment.
It really is.
He even loved to joke with his community. Like, an elderly woman once approached him and asked if she would go to paradise. And he looked at her with a completely straight face and said, "Old ladies cannot enter paradise."
Which naturally causes the poor woman to burst into tears.
I mean, you can't blame her. But he immediately stops her and delivers the punchline. He explains, "Don't cry. Old ladies can't enter paradise because God will first recreate them into young maidens, and then they will enter paradise."
That's great. It's an innocent, endearing joke that shows a leader who didn't take himself too seriously.
But to truly measure the magnitude of what this gentle, approachable man accomplished, we really have to zoom out.
We do. We need to examine the specific petri dish that forged him.
Right. We are talking about pre-Islamic Arabia, an era historically known as the Jahiliyyah, or the Age of Ignorance. So let's set the stage. The lineage traces his ancestry through Adnan, straight back to Ishmael and Abraham. And Abraham left a monumental cultural and religious footprint in Mecca. He built the Kaaba, instituted the Hajj pilgrimage, established the sacred months where tribal warfare was strictly forbidden.
And crucially, he made a very specific prayer, asking God to send a prophet from his own descendants.
Exactly. Geopolitically, the Arabian Peninsula was a vast, unforgiving desert positioned directly between the two ancient superpowers.
Right, the Byzantine Empire to the northwest and the Sassanid Persian Empire to the northeast.
So what does this all mean? If you are strategically planning to launch a massive religious and political revolution, wouldn't you want to start in Rome or Persia?
You in Sim?
Right. You'd want infrastructure, paved roads, centralized wealth, and established communication networks. Why initiate a global movement in a barren, isolated desert filled with deeply fractured, warring tribes?
Historical analysis points to a fascinating concept here, which is the civilizational vacuum.
A civilizational vacuum? Tell me about that.
Well, if you attempt to plant a radical new worldview in Rome or Persia, you immediately collide with massive entrenched state ideologies.
Sure, they have their own religions and laws.
Exactly. You face complex bureaucracies, sophisticated military machines, a long history of colonialism. Arabia had none of that machinery. There was no deep-seated centralized state apparatus to crush this new innate message of monotheism before it could take root.
It was essentially a political blank slate.
Exactly. And we really cannot understate how the harshness of the desert environment shaped its people. Surviving in that climate bred individuals with unparalleled physical and mental resilience.
Because they had to be tough just to live.
Right. They lacked formal education, but they possessed a fierce, uncompromising bravery and a strict code of tribal honor. When an Arab made a promise, they would literally rather die than break it.
Wow.
Those specific raw materials, toughness, extreme loyalty, and raw courage, were the exact ingredients required to survive the brutal early struggles of establishing Islam.
So, if the desert was a brutal place that rewarded physical strength and powerful tribal backing, the absolute ultimate test of that environment would be entering it with neither.
Oh, absolutely.
And that is exactly how his story begins, the orphan's journey. There is some historical debate over his precise birth date in the month of Rabiul Awal, whether it's the 12th, the 10th, the 2nd, or the 8th. But we know he was born in the year of the elephant.
Right.
The most defining, heart-wrenching fact of his arrival, however, is that his father, Abdullah, dies before he even takes his first breath.
And following the ancient custom of the Meccan nobility, the fatherless infant was meant to be sent out into the deep desert with a Bedouin wet nurse.
To protect him from disease.
Yes, it protected city-born infants from urban plagues, but it also immersed them in the pure, unadulterated Arabic language of the nomadic tribes.
But when the wet nurses arrived in Mecca to select infants, nobody wanted him.
Nobody.
Because he was an orphan, there was no wealthy patriarch to guarantee them a handsome wage. He was passed over time and time again.
Until Lama.
Right. Finally, a woman named Halima agreed to take him, but only out of desperation because she was the last woman without a child and just couldn't bear the shame of returning home empty-handed. Here's where it gets really interesting, though.
Yeah.
Isn't it profound that history's most revered, celebrated man started his life as its most vulnerable, literally rejected by society because he lacked financial value?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, theological scholars view this as God's deliberate method of nurturing his character.
How so?
Well, Halima experiences immediate inexplicable blessings upon adopting him. Her frail camel suddenly produces abundant milk. Her exhausted donkey outpaces the entire caravan.
Oh, wow.
But the vulnerability is the entire point. By being subjected to such profound, compounding loss from his very first moments, he was forced to develop an unparalleled, fiercely authentic sense of empathy.
Compounding loss is definitely the right phrase. He spends his early years in the desert with Halima, where we actually have the account of the Archangel Gabriel physically opening his chest at age 4 to remove a dark sliver from his heart, basically purifying him of selfish inclination.
Like the chest opening incident.
But almost immediately after he is returned to his biological family in Mecca, the trauma resumes. His mother, Amina, falls ill and dies in front of him when he is only 6.
Just devastating.
And then the loving grandfather who took him in, he dies when the boy is only 8.
He is orphaned over and over and over again. And the psychological weight of that abandonment, it never really left him.
How could it?
Right. We have a deeply moving historical account from 50 years later. He is a senior, powerful leader, traveling with an army of companions, and he suddenly takes a detour to a quiet, remote village.
Okay.
He finds a specific grave, sits down beside it, and just begins to weep. Mm. He cries so profusely that his entire beard becomes soaked with tears.
Oh my goodness, the companions watching him begin to weep as well, don't they? Simply from the overwhelming force of his raw grief, even before they know whose grave it is.
Exactly. He eventually turns to them and explains that he had asked God for permission to visit his mother's grave.
Wow.
Think about the psychology of that moment. Half a century had passed. He had led armies, built a society, endured wars. But the visceral pain of a 6-year-old boy watching his mother die was still resting right there on the surface of his heart.
That is just so deeply human.
It is. That is why, years later, when he famously promises paradise to anyone who takes care of an orphan, he isn't lecturing from a place of abstract political theory. He is speaking from the deepest well of personal empathy.
He lived every ounce of that pain.
Exactly.
But, you know, how does a child carrying that mountain of trauma grow up to become a functional leader of men?
It starts with his very first job.
Right. As a young man, he worked as a shepherd, tending flocks in the surrounding hills for mere pennies. I was reflecting on this earlier, and shepherding is essentially an ancient leadership incubator.
I love that framing.
Yeah, because you are out there in the total solitude of nature. You are managing a flock of animals that are notoriously stubborn and constantly prone to wandering off a cliff.
Yeah.
It demands a highly nuanced mix of tenderness to guide and heal the weak and sheer bravery to fight off wolves and predators. It's the ultimate training ground for managing the complexities of a human society.
He actually confirmed that exact sentiment later in life.
Oh, really?
Yeah, telling his companions that God never sent a single prophet throughout history, except that he was first trained as a shepherd.
Wow, that's fascinating.
It forces humility right into your bones. You cannot be arrogant when you spend your days doing menial, dusty labor for pennies. But as he matured, he began translating that quiet leadership into the complex social fabric of Mecca.
Like in his teenage years.
Right. When he was around 15, he participated in the Fijr Wars. He didn't engage in direct combat, but he gathered stray arrows from the battlefield for his uncles. And he later stated he had no regrets about being there because they were fighting to defend a just cause.
That inherent drive toward justice really solidifies when he's 20 years old with an event called the Ilf al-Futl.
Yes, the Pact of Justice.
So a Yemeni merchant traveled to Mecca for the Hajj pilgrimage and was completely swindled out of his goods by a powerful local politician. The merchant begged the tribal leaders for help, but they ignored him because the politician was simply too wealthy and influential to cross.
The foreigner was utterly vulnerable. Until he stood by the Kaaba and publicly shamed the city's leaders through poetry.
Poetry was a big deal back then.
Huge. The public embarrassment prompted the Ilf al-Futl, which was a binding pact forged by a group of conscientious men, to stand up and forcefully protect the oppressed.
Yeah.
Completely regardless of their tribal affiliation or social standing.
And the prophet enthusiastically joined this pact.
He did.
Even decades later, after receiving prophethood, he praised that treaty highly, saying he would gladly join it again. Imagine how watching older men broker a universal justice pact in an otherwise lawless society shaped his future political strategies. It's a massive precedent.
It absolutely is. It demonstrates that he was actively championing justice and the betterment of civil society alongside non-Muslims long before he had a divine mandate to do so.
Right. He was just a good person.
Exactly. Advocating for neutral matters of goodness, truth, and basic human rights in your local community is often the most profound way to demonstrate the sincerity of your character. You don't have to wait for a religious banner to do the right thing.
And that stellar character, that rock-solid reputation for absolute integrity, is exactly what catches the eye of a powerful Meccan noblewoman named Khadija.
Khadija, she's such a crucial figure.
She really is. She was wealthy, highly respected, and she hires this young, honest man to lead a critical trade mission to Syria. He executes the mission brilliantly, dealing with immense transparency and returning with multiplied profits.
Khadija was a sharp businesswoman. She observed his flawless character, and she was actually the one who initiated the marriage proposal through a mutual friend.
And his reaction to the proposal is so telling. He is genuinely shocked. He says, "Why would she want to marry me? I am a poor orphan."
There's that deep-seated humility rising up again.
Right, but they do marry. And his uncle, Abu Islieb, delivers this beautiful wedding sermon where he addresses the class difference head-on. He says, "Yes, my nephew lacks wealth, but wealth is just a fleeting shadow. In manners, nobility, and lineage, he has no equal."
There is actually an interesting historical footnote regarding Khadija's age at the time of their marriage.
Oh, about the debate over how old she was.
Yeah. The most widely cited traditional number is that she was 40 years old.
Yeah.
However, strong early historical evidence from authorities like Ibn Ishaq suggests she may have actually been 28.
And practically speaking, 28 makes a lot of logical sense when you consider that they went on to have 6 children together over the course of their marriage.
Exactly. Regardless of the exact age gap, what is universally agreed upon is the profound strength and singular nature of their partnership.
Right.
They remained in a strictly monogamous marriage for 25 years. She was his absolute rock, providing a fortress of emotional support and financial independence, which became absolutely critical when the crushing burdens of prophethood finally began.
But the tragic theme of loss that defined his childhood relentlessly follows him into his role as a father. I just want you to imagine the sheer weight of this grief for a second.
It's unimaginably heavy.
Over the years, they welcome children into their home, Kasim, Zainab, Ruqayya, Kulthum, Abdullah, and later he has a son named Ibrahim, and he buries almost every single one of them.
Yeah.
6 of his 7 children die while he is alive to mourn them. Only his daughter, Fatima, outlives him. How does a human being carry the bodies of 6 children to the graveyard after already losing their parents and their grandfather without their mind completely breaking?
This raises a really important question about the theology of trials.
Right. Why would God subject his most beloved messenger to that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Why subject him to the most agonizing, unnatural pain a human can possibly endure? The theological explanation is that extreme hardship, when channeled correctly, prevents the heart from calcifying into arrogance.
Oh, wow.
It breeds a state of complete, unshakable reliance on God, a concept known as tawakkul. By being tested far more severely than the rest of humanity, his role as a spiritual guide was cemented.
That makes a lot of sense.
His belief was forged in a fire so intensely hot that it became practically indestructible. He wasn't shielded from the human experience. He was subjected to the absolute crushing extremes of it, so he could guide others through their own darkness.
So let's trace the arc of the journey we've taken today.
Okay, let's recap.
We started with a cosmic name that means continuous global praise. But the reality on the desert floor was a vulnerable, rejected orphan who nobody wanted. We saw a solitary shepherd tending flocks who matured into a young man championing justice for vulnerable strangers. And we saw a devoted husband tested by an almost incomprehensible level of personal grief, yet who maintained a character so incredibly gentle he wouldn't even sigh at a servant who made a mistake.
Every single phase was building the internal architecture needed for the mission he was about to receive. And, you know, I want to leave you with a deeply symbolic historical event that perfectly encapsulates what his life's work would ultimately become.
I would love that.
About 5 years before his prophethood officially began, the Kaaba in Mecca was heavily damaged by a flash flood and needed to be entirely rebuilt.
And because resources were so scarce in the desert, they actually had to salvage wood from a wrecked Roman ship that had washed ashore on the Red Sea coast to rebuild it, right?
Yes, exactly. But here is the powerful metaphor to reflect on. When they rebuilt the Kaaba, the foundation of the building, the ancient footprint in the earth itself, remained exactly the same as Abraham had laid it centuries prior. Only the bricks, the dressing, the walls were renewed. The prophet didn't emerge from the desert to invent a brand new, unprecedented foundation for human morality. He came to rebuild and renew the bricks of Abraham's ancient, pure monotheism.
Wow.
He came to take a tribal society that was on the brink of moral and civil collapse and set it back down onto its original, solid foundation.
Rebuilding the bricks of an ancient foundation. What an incredible image to close on. It takes us right back to our opening question about the man emerging from the desert. He wasn't building an empire out of nowhere. He was uncovering a truth that had been buried by time. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into his early life. Keep asking questions, keep seeking knowledge, and we'll see you next time.